Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is Constitution Week. As a matter of fact, yesterday was Constitution Day. And we've got Paul. Paul, welcome back. We're going to go through the color-coded Constitution, folks. The language is the same. The only difference, and as a matter of fact, I think you'll find, Paul, that I actually have some little inserts that I have in here regarding notes and so forth that I wanted to make. And for the most part, I really probably need to add a lot more as far as notes go. But I guess I have to be kind of careful for promulgating that, because when people actually read my words, I hope they don't think that that's actually part of the Constitution. But anywho, welcome back.
Thank you.
And so I'll go ahead and set the stage. As most people are aware that, you know, we had this revolution, and the premise that was established in the resolution that, you know, governments are instituted by men, and that governments serve a very specific purpose, that they are to, you know, one, that we establish them by the consent of the governed. In other words, we have to consent in establishing government, that they just can't form themselves and force themselves upon us, which is what we're seeing and what we're dealing with today. And more importantly, the government and the purpose of government is to basically protect our inalienable rights. And of those, it is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and, you know, property, all of those types of things. But they didn't create a comprehensive list. Instead, what they did was, you know, they evolved in trying to create a very limited government. The very first government, and as a matter of fact, the Constitution was established under the Articles of Association.
Of association or confederation?
Of association. So, in other words, as the states basically formed this Continental Congress, they created the Articles of Association to do that, so that they, you know, all agreed on what to, you know, because you don't want to go in and have a couple of states feel that, you know, this Continental Congress has to have more energy and a few other states not. And so they all had to agree on what they were going to basically create a union to do. And then the declaration was submitted, which, you know, political correctness came into play. And so, you know, they moved forward into the revolution, and we ended the revolution. And while we were in the process of ending the revolution, or the last few years of it, was the formation of the Articles of Confederation. Now, technically, the Articles of Confederation came out, I want to say, 1777, 1778, something like that. But they weren't fully ratified until 1781. In other words, they weren't, you know, in force until then. And as soon as the Articles of Confederation were in force, well, all of a sudden we started realizing that, hey, we got problems. And instantly the initial amendments to the Articles of Confederation started popping up. And see, I think this is where some people, you know, kind of miss this. And as a matter of fact, I want to kind of pull this up. I think I got it right here. I want to make sure I do. I'm hoping that that's what this is.
Well, while you're pulling that up, GR, I want you to know that I just pulled up the Articles of Association, and in all of my study, this is the first time I've ever heard of it.
Oh, really?
Yes.
All right. Well, great.
I did. Yeah, it predates the Articles of Confederation, and it makes sense, okay? But I had never seen it before. It's only about seven paragraphs, but it's right there in the National Archives.
Yes, and so actually you're going to love this too, because where are we at? Rogue Island, the proceedings, some remedies, effects, let me see here. Because what I want to do is I want to dive into the defects, and that's what I think we were looking at. Was that it? The defects of the federal government, 1786. Is this what I'm looking for? No, that's not it. I'm going to keep going. Let me see here. It is, you'll find this on the documentation history of the Constitution, which is the University of Wisconsin. And the amendments that instantly were created. Now, remember, when did I say that it was fully ratified when it went into effect?
The Constitution was fully ratified?
Yes.
That was
not the Constitution, not the Articles of Confederation. When were the?
Oh, I missed that.
Okay, that's okay. 1781.
Okay.
It was written in, I think, 1777, 1776, somewhere in, I think it was 77, because they realized that they needed to have a little bit more energy in this central government, in this Continental Congress. So they gave, you know, they said, hey, we got to give ourselves more power. And it took a little while. It took, you know, well, they were fighting a war and all of that, but it wasn't fully ratified until 1781. And that was March 1781. In February of 1781, an amendment already was put forth because they said, you know what, before we even kick the tires on this, we already find a defect in this. And this basically was to grant the Continental Congress power to collect import duties. And then the next, and then in March, as it was being ratified, finally, they wanted an amendment to give Congress coercive power over the states and their citizens. And then in 1781, in August, they wanted to basically amend it to basically create, you know, into effect additional powers needed by Congress. And they go on. So there's a few more amendments in 1783, two more amendments, 1784, another amendment, and then 1785, an amendment, and 1786, another. And all of these amendments are different. They're not the same amendments. And every single one of these fell flat. They failed. Why? Because they required another state, one specific state, to go along.
Rhode Island.
Right. And so you've heard me call them Rogue Island. And actually, if you look up Rogue Island, you'll actually find out that that's what they called it. That became the prevailing nickname for Rhode Island. And so,
GR,
go ahead.
Let me ask you a question.
Uh-huh.
What was up with Rhode Island? It seemed like they said no to just about everything. So what was the culture? What was going on in that state that they just were the pebble in the shoe? Okay, any idea? What was that? What was going on there? Because that, I mean, they earned this nickname, Rogue Island.
Yeah, okay? and at the time. It's not that they, you know, they didn't have, you know, some population significance. As a matter of fact, let me pull that up because that helps, you know, place context as well. When we look at the statehood order, you know, Rhode Island, when the Constitution was being ratified, Rhode Island had 68,000 citizens or people, and they were the third from the smallest. In other words, Delaware, and believe it or not, Delaware and Georgia had basically less than 60,000. And so wow. Rhode Island, so the three smallest states was those two and Rhode Island. And so they were, you know, they were just riding the big dogs, and they basically, you know, I guess it was a Napoleon complex, right? Maybe, you know, well, you can't do anything without our approval, and we're not going to approve anything. they only cared about getting through the war. And by the time the Articles of Confederation were ratified, the war was pretty much close to being over, even though there were critical battles. But it really did seem like in the growth and the movement of American sovereignty became more and more prevailing. And so I don't want to say it was a done deal. There were some key battles that had to be fought. But bottom line, I think most people were looking at, we're going to win this war, because there's just no way Britain can project the force necessary to come after this entire, you know, all of these states. We're just too big. And and so anyway, Rhode Island, for whatever reason, they just didn't want to be, you know, along with the ride, other than for the protection of it. It was just like, you know, you've heard the concept safety in numbers. They just came aboard because they wanted to be safe.
Right.
And if you look at the size of Rhode Island, it's just, it's teeny. I mean,
it is.
I don't know how long it takes to drive across and drive through, but I'm just, in today's traffic, because there's a lot of people that live in that whole area, because I can imagine it may take some time, but it's a very small state. And it has sovereignty and this level of recognition. So having the progressives, if we actually did things incrementally, the way the progressives have been doing this and destroying the states, you know, maybe, you know, to teach Rhode Island or teach people the lesson of, you know, what tyranny can be, is wiping out Rhode Island to say you're too small to be a state to actually have equal say as the rest of us. You bring nothing to the table. But that's not our form of government. Our form of government is recognizing the sovereignty of the people and the government that they instituted in sending delegates to form this federal government. In other words, the sovereigns being the states. So
I just looked it up, GR.
Yeah.
It'd take 45 minutes to drive across Rhode Island.
Okay, so back
2 hours was stopped.
So back to this history.
Go ahead.
Back to the, I'm trying to set the stage. That the Articles of Confederation were such an abject failure that prior to the Constitutional Convention, because they had actually had a couple of committees, or I should say outside of Continental Congress, the states sent delegates to say, what are we going to do? Now, why did the states send delegates to a completely independent meeting like at the convention in Annapolis? It was a convention of state delegates that went to Annapolis, Maryland to meet to discuss the defects of the Articles of Confederation, which they called their constitution. So why was that happening that way? Okay, I'll answer the question. So looking at the Articles of Confederation, who possessed the cognizance, the authority, the unbridled authority over the compact, amending it, and so forth? The states. There was really no responsibility or role for Continental Congress to be involved in any amendment, other than the fact that they will not allow any law to go into force if all states do not acquiesce. And you'll find it in, I believe, the 13th article of the Articles of Confederation. And it's, boom, that's it. I mean, that's the only thing that the Continental Congress has any of their fingers in that Constitution. Which means that they didn't have the ability to call, or if the states wanted to have a convention, they wouldn't have the responsibility of calling that. They had no role whatsoever. So the states had to do this. The states had to be the adults, they had to be the parents, and they had to, you know, say, okay, we need to behave better. So Virginia, New York, and a few other states got together. They've been getting together, and they finally said, you know what, look, this ain't cutting it. We actually have to have a convention to basically to do what's necessary to give this general government the necessary power so we can save. And prior to the Annapolis, or post the Annapolis convention, which was in 1786, I think it was in the fall of 1786, like November, maybe October, November timeframe. But after that, in 1787, William Barton wrote a plea, basically commentaries on the problems under the Articles of Confederation, and a plea for the United States to actually write a new constitution to give this federal government, to this general government, more power. And then Benjamin Rush of, and I believe William Barton, I think is Pennsylvania. And then Benjamin Rush of Massachusetts, then James Madison of Virginia. So Rush wrote a compelling letter in January of 1787. Madison wrote his in April of 1787. And then Harrington basically wrote a letter, and it's the longest letter that was written. And this was basically an appeal to the people, not to just the states or state legislatures. This was appeal to the people to actually really open up to make these wholesale changes that are necessary to their government.
Are you saying, GR, that there was a prevailing feeling or understanding that the Articles of Confederation just weren't up to the task?
Absolutely. Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I'm going to do something while we're on air, and I'm going to try to send you an email, and I'm going to send you an email that will have a document in it, because what I have is the Empowering Acts of Congress, or I should say of the state legislatures, so that, and so you can hear me turning my back towards the microphone. So that you can actually see the sentiments of the states. And so...
Okay. Do you also have Harrington's letter?
I don't have it to send to you, but I have a link and I can pull it in. What's important, though, is the fact that what I'm going to send you is a consolidation. And sorry about that. It's a consolidation of what all these states did to basically authorize this constitutional convention. And the reason why this is important is because somebody actually has a $10,000 bounty if you can prove that the constitutional convention wasn't a runaway convention.
Wow.
And so I'm going to give you that evidence, and I believe that this evidence right here will really help lay that foundation, because I just sent it to you. You're going to read in this how each of the states basically committed to sending delegates to the Constitutional Convention. And so here's the question. The only way that the Constitutional Convention and the delegates going to this could be considered as runaway, outside the scope, they exceeded their commission. That's what, you know, is being argued by, you know, this quasi proponent for the Constitution, and basically convincing everybody that the Constitution was written outside the authority. In other words, it's an illegitimate document. And so let me know if you got the email. So, folks, you're kind of watching, you know, sparks, data, ones and zeros flying around the United States that just, you know, went from one coast all the way, almost all the way across the nation to where Paul is sitting in some rural area of Missouri. And so, did you get the
when
email?
When it pops up, I'll let you know. I'm standing by for it.
Okay, so let me make sure I actually sent it. Okay, and so sorry for this, folks, but this is kind of important. I should have done this beforehand.
Got it.
Okay, great. Now, when you open that up, what I did was I highlighted the fact of how the states basically, how each state said whatever, you know, the committee believes is necessary to render the adequate powers. In other words, I don't want to just guess what I said. I want to be very clear on what we're talking about. And so when I look at the Continental Congress, where is this? Resource material. Yeah, it's right there, State Empowering Acts. Okay, so this is what I sent. And so, folks, I'm going to read. This is the common sentiment of the states. All of the states. There were only two states that had reservation clauses in what they said. And they said, they're sending these delegates actually to attend the said convention and are hereby authorized and empowered to represent the state therein, to confer with such delegates appointed by the several states for the purposes mentioned in the said acts of Congress. In other words, Congress is saying, we need more power. We need to change this government. That may be so for the said acts of Congress that may be present and duly empowered to act in said convention and discuss upon such alterations and provisions agreeable to the general principles of a Republican government as they shall think proper. In other words, they're not telling them that they have to think a certain way. They're giving them full license under the principles of a Republican form of government that they think proper to render the federal constitution adequate. In other words, make the changes to make this thing adequate to the exigencies of government and the preservation of the union. So tell me what those guys did was exceeding the scope of what the state told them to do.
So let me ask you a question then. Where are the statements that require states to simply improve
okay, so what you have to have, and you don't see this, but what they're basically quoting here is the exact language out of what came from Continental Congress to say, you know, states, we recommend that you convene a convention to basically to amend and or alter and provide the necessary provisions agreeable so that we can actually create a constitution that gives us the adequate powers to do what we need to do. And so all of the states basically came along and said, okay, we want to do that. And actually, we will allow our delegates to let them decide what they think is proper, because that's what it says right there, as they shall think proper. So when you go through all of these different state commissions, because this is the individual commission I just read out of Connecticut, I can go into every single state, and they all basically parrot the exact same words. So let me ask you this. Where is this hard confinement that they are not to actually utilize their brains in coming up with the most efficacious government possible? Mm-hmm. Where does Mr. Brown get away with saying that this was a runaway convention, you know, and they knew what they were doing was wrong? Now, they're granted, he's basing everything on hearsay, because what he does is he cites how Patrick Henry basically made this huge assertion that, you know, this was a runaway convention. He didn't use those words, but he basically said that they exceeded their commission. And many of the states basically tried to hold him to that. And so when they actually, you know, ceased the debates and argued whether they exceeded their commission, which we don't have records of those, we only have the records of the debates on the convention. And so when we look at what the state actually said, like Virginia with Patrick Henry, you know, and you read the Virginia Commission says the exact same thing, which is why, you know, they basically put the argument aside and says, are you kidding me? They had all.
Wasn't Patrick Henry an anti-federalist?
Yes, he was. But that's so the anti-federalists were doing everything they could to kill the Constitution, and they came up with this cockamamie excuse that, oh, they exceeded their commission. But when they actually read the commission that the state gave them to go represent them, what they were saying wasn't there. And which is why when they actually came to vote as the body of the delegates, they said, no, they didn't exceed their commission. They did what we believe is necessary. And folks, we're going into break. So unfortunately, we'll have to, you know, cool off a little bit, or I'll have to, you know, settle down a little bit. But we're going to go into break, and I'll let you think about this, because there's $10,000 out there for anybody that wants to just actually start going through this and then saying, give me the evidence that it was a runaway I have evidence that they had all the license necessary. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so I'm sure that Paul was kind of going through what I just sent him and looking at all the green. Now, even though I have yellow, I think, for Massachusetts, if you actually read what Massachusetts says, they basically say, well, go and do the same thing, except they have a little clause in there that as long as what they do does not change this one part of Article 5 in the Articles of Confederation, they wanted to make sure that this one thing didn't get touched. And so some of the things that actually came out was they realized that, I think, in one of the states, I think it was either New York or Massachusetts, was the power to recall their representatives. And so that was actually placed onto the table. And it's not that the state can't recall them, but and because they can charge them with treason, they didn't give them Section 3 of the 14th Amendment yet, but under the apparently under Article 5 of the Articles of Confederation, there were, you know, these, I say, consequences that the states possessed over their public servants in the Continental Congress. So anyway, that all being said, even though those two states had hard stipulations that they can't touch those things, or these things are not alterable, everything else is open. Mm-hmm. Did you hear what I just said? Everything is open for alteration. In other words, if you got to rewrite it, rewrite it.
Mm-hmm.
And so many of the men, when they first started, and actually you got to know that Virginia went in with a plan to rewrite it.
Okay.
And when I say Virginia, I'm talking about the governor of Virginia and the delegates who met before the Constitutional Convention, Governor Morris, Madison, Mason, and the rest of them, and they were going to propose a plan that would have changed the makeup of Congress to an apportionment by population and so forth, and that was called the Virginia Plan. So in other words,
sure. They showed up with this plan.
That's right. So they walked in with a plan to completely change, one, the government and so forth. So anyway, I think the real understanding that there's like this bounty proved, I'll give anybody $10,000 that can prove that that convention was not a runaway convention. I actually just proved that it wasn't. And the question is, how can you prove that it was? Here are the commissions. Where did they provide any, you know, confinement on these men, these delegates, that they could not do this? How did you even come up with this? Oh, because they read letters, and these people with, let's just say, nefarious intent, you know, made insinuations that the Constitutional Convention was a runaway convention. And what these people who claim to be proponents, John Birch Society, what these people are doing is they're, one, sullying the name, and they're actually supporting the progressive movement in putting completely wholesale, putting aside the Constitution and saying, we need to go in a completely different direction because that's illegitimate. And so What I'm trying to basically say is, folks, there's $10,000 out there, but I'll bet you anything, once you've actually go down this argument, that person that puts the $10,000 on the line, I don't think they'll pay. Because I just don't think that they're willing to actually go through that and admit. I think it's just a bunch of hyperbole, and it's just a bunch of talk. But, you know, I think that this would actually probably prove to be – what's your thoughts on it, Paul? Do you think this would go into – we can't go into small claims court. It's $10,000.
GR, I guess – I'm not going to touch it because this guy's a friend of mine. I certainly would look forward to having a conversation with him at this time, but I really don't want to touch it. Okay.
I understand. No, but do you see anywhere in these commissions that the states are basically empowering these men as delegates to go represent them? Do you see anywhere where they don't have the latitude to actually completely change and rewrite a whole new constitution if necessary?
I'm reading the commissions. I've got them right in front of me. And they appear to be given – in fact, it almost appears that every state has given the latitude for their delegates to consider whatever is necessary.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. To resolve the issues of the Articles of Confederation,
right? Absolutely. You'll only find that the two states. Again, I just quickly glance at these things, and it doesn't take me long to understand that they're all parroting the exact same words. If you notice.
Yeah, quick question. You've got some highlights in yellow, and I haven't read them all. What are the ones in yellow? Because Massachusetts has got. Is there, and so is Delaware. Has something in yellow.
Okay. So
Massachusetts.
So if you look, Delaware, the fifth article of the Confederation of the said states, finally ratified on the year 10,000, which declares in determining questions in the United States Congress, assemble each state to have one vote. So they wanted to make sure that they weren't going to change. That each state would have one vote. In other words, the state suffrage. In other words,
I can see why Delaware would want that,
right? Okay, so there was that. There was Massachusetts that also had a fifth article that I think if you read it, for the annual election of delegates in Congress with the power reserved to each state to recall its delegates of any of them within the year to send others in their stead. So in other words, the New York or Massachusetts wanted to be able to have this wholesale, you know, we're getting rid of all of you guys if we have to, the power to recall them. And so that was a reservation. And when we get to, I think it's New York that had another one. It might jump out. Well, actually, no. No, but you'll notice in Pennsylvania, I have a yellow little highlight to George Clymer.
By George Clymer's name. What's up with that one?
Well, don't you know a Clymer of Pennsylvania?
I do know a Clymer in Pennsylvania, and I've asked him directly if he's related to this George Clymer, and I think he's still checking on that.
Okay. All right, so fair enough. But I highlighted what I saw were the only constraints that, you know, go do what you need to, but don't touch this. So how does anybody come to the conclusion that they were tight? They were only there to amend the Articles of Confederation, not to rewrite it?
Right.
That as soon as they did that, they became a runaway convention. This has been a prevailing. And so I think what happens is somebody comes up with this idea that this is, you know, this really sounds good. You throw these ideas on the wall and that one's stuck. And they go, runaway convention. Wow, that, you know, I like that. And so they get married to it. And next thing you know, they can't get rid of it. It's like a ship that they have to go down with. They have that attachment to it.
Okay.
Anyway.
All right. So where are we?
So what I'm doing is I'm laying out what happens. And so the states actually sent these guys and actually gave them all the latitude. the only state that actually showed up and the delegates went right back was Rhode Island. And I actually don't have, if you notice, I don't have Rhode Island here.
Right.
Because Rhode Island basically absolved themselves from the Union by not being there. And they said, we're not going to ratify this. What ended up happening was Rhode Island just basically says, we're abstaining, we're removing ourselves from this. And eventually they came back and ratified the Constitution without actually ratifying it. In other words, the state legislature, without having a convention, as required by the U.S. Constitution, that each state have a convention of the people, representatives of the people, to basically debate this Constitution for its ratification. What Rhode Island actually did was they just had the state legislature ratify it.
So they didn't even, okay. So they just kind of rubber stamped it.
Yes, they really, really rubber stamped it, because that's when they realized that they had to go in, because they were the only state that didn't ratify it. And they realized this, their size and so forth, they could have easily been absorbed into another state.
Okay.
And they wanted to preserve their footing and their sovereignty and so forth. So they finally came in, and begrudgingly.
Oops.
That's right.
You're right.
So actually, and here's the funny thing, because they were so obstinate, the argument is actually out there that the Constitutional Convention and the openness of the Constitutional Convention was of such because of Rhode Island. In other words, had a couple of amendments passed, at least a couple of amendments had passed, then this convention in Philadelphia really would have only made minor changes. But because Rhode Island was so obstinate, they had to change that one part that required a unanimous consent, say, that's gone. Obviously, we cannot live in a union with one person that's going to hold us hostage, with one state that'll hold us hostage. So, in other words, they're the ones that actually created the impetus.
We have Rhode Island to thank.
Yes, right? Yes, absolutely. They created such, I'll just say, such an error that, wow, we really got to fix this. And what they did was just absolutely amazing. So now that they had this convention and we just went through the ratifications of it, we're now actually going to go through this just like they should have, line by line. And so I'm just kind of, I wanted to set the stage. So usually it takes a little while, but I thank you for indulging me.
Oh, that's fine.
Okay.
I'm here for the ride. Okay. So we got about 15 minutes. So where are we going to start?
Well, let's start with, now folks, we're not going to read the color code at the top. You're more than welcome to read that so that you can look at what red with yellow text means and red with black text and orange and yellow and then the green. And so
you want to tell your listeners where this is on your website?
Oh, sure. This is on the Constitutional Articles page on Reclaiming the Republic. So go to reclaimingtherepublic.org and on the Constitutional Articles, it's towards the very bottom. I think it's the third from the bottom. So just search for color-coded Constitution. Once I get the website redone, I'm working on that right now. And once we get the website redone, anything that you may be looking for, you can just search color-coded or what have you, and it'll come up with results. So you can actually start searching my entire site, you know, from the homepage. So you can go to everything. It's going to be a major uplifting or a major facelift, if I can say it that way. But anyway. All right. So let me go ahead and read this preamble. So we've talked about a preamble before, right? And a preamble is basically an introduction to kind of give you an idea of what you're going to be getting in this Constitution. The preamble grants no powers. It has no legal standing. It is just an introduction. And it is a formal introduction, but not legally binding powers or anything like that. Does that make sense?
Sure does.
Okay. All right, so we, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, and provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Now, what I didn't say was what this actually said just days before the Constitution was printed. What this actually said was, we the people of the state of Delaware, of the state of Georgia, of the state of, and they listed every single state in the Union, including Rhode Island. And then all of a sudden they said, you know what? We're putting into print something that may not be. What if Rhode Island doesn't join? They left. Mm-hmm. And so they said, well, let's not include the we the people of the states. We the people of the United States, those states who unite. And that was a capital mm-hmm. U, unite, not a little u. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the we the people had really nothing to do with we the people as a form of democracy. It was we the people of the sovereign of states. There you go.
Right.
Okay. Now, so Article 1 is the article that dives into the state, or I should say the legislative body, because the Constitution creates three bodies or three branches, and the first and the most powerful is the legislative. So go ahead and read Section 1.
Okay.
Okay.
All legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States, which shall consist of a Senate and House of Representatives.
Okay, so this is the first part that's highlighted. Very first, I mean, the first words of the Constitution highlighted in red with yellow text. In other words, this is very seriously and egregiously being violated. Because mm-hmm. if the concept is in a Republican government that those people who govern us, those who make our laws, are our own representatives that we have control over by the direct ballot, well, if it's only given to them, then only they can make law. And clearly, we've had presidents, executives, make law. And we've had, and obviously everybody knows that the judiciary, the bench, has constantly been making law. They would make a ruling and say, well, we see the Constitution this way, and now this is the law. And this is how they came forth with this concept of a living Constitution and the annotated Constitution, and how the laws of the Constitution is completely morphed into things that it has no, the states have never delegated those powers, those, that capability, so forth and so on. So, I mean, this is a bad and egregious violation, and we sure. actually have to get the Congress to start standing up for their separation of powers and this exclusive authority. Go ahead.
GR, the operative word here is all.
And, yes.
And what you've pointed out about Congress standing up, they should be jealously guarding their authority to create law.
You know why they're not?
And they're, no, tell me why they're not.
Because
I've got a hint, but
because if they did it, then they would be held accountable. The states would basically come after them. But if the court does it, then they, oh, well, we didn't do that. But, hey, they ruled that that's how it is, and this is how they aggrandized each other.
Well, guess what? They should still be held accountable because of that word
all. Yes. Oh, yeah, now, absolutely.
And there's one other thing I think you didn't mention, and that is we have got, I love your video about the three vetoes of the Department of Transportation. Mm-hmm. Because what has happened is we've got agencies who have combined the legislative and executive and judicial judicial powers in each of the agencies.
Right.
So they have, you now have something called Article One courts. You know what they are? They are these agencies that have their own rules and their own supposed power of enforcing their laws, judging you against them, and fining you. Yep. Or punishing you.
Right. Judge, okay. Jury, executioner, so, all of that. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right. So this is, and in fact, there's an entire branch of law now known as administrative law. So again, this is something else that violates Section 1 of the Constitution, where all legislative powers and granted shall be vested in the Congress of the United States.
Correct. Correct. And so here's the other thing. You got to understand mm-hmm. that the president has a check on these legislative powers. Mm-hmm. Where is the check and balance on the judiciary legislative authority that they've usurped? In other words, can the president veto those?
No, but Congress has the check on the judiciary. They can determine. The jurisdiction.
Yes, they can. Right? Yes, they can. But see, for Congress to actually stand up to the judiciary, they would have to they'd have to let the genie out of the bottle, because who would they have to go to basically place that check on the judiciary? Let's talk about what we were just talking about with the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions. They would need the states to actually interpose and say, you can't do that. And the last thing that the creature, you remember, the creature in this context isn't Hamilton, it is the federal government. And the last thing the creature uh-huh. wants to do is to wake the beast. The states are the beast. When they coalesce, when the states combine, they become the beast that can actually dismantle this Leviathan, this supernatural Leviathan that has been formed, that seems formidable by all who see the United States. It's just, how can you defeat that monster? Because mm-hmm. the states are the beast that can actually do that. So Section 2, we're going to dive now into the House of Representatives and apportionment and so forth. And so, the House. I'll read this, and then we'll highlight the part that I've read that was a violation. So the House of Representatives shall be composed of members chosen every second year by the people of the several states, and the electors of each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislature. So in other words, the electors, this is the people, they're introducing this new body, and the electors are those people who choose the president. And in mm-hmm. each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislature. So in other words, go ahead.
I have a question. Why is the electors introduced here instead of in Article 2?
Well, because they're basically saying that the people have two separate representatives. A representative that represents their suffrage in the House of Representatives when they create law, and a representative mm-hmm. in choosing the president of the United States for them. In other words, in both cases, the people are not voting directly for the law, or they're not voting directly for the president. They are to choose two people to represent them. Now, you got to understand that an elector chosen in 1789 was a person that assumed this duty for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And as they assumed that duty, they then had an involvement in what was going on, so that when the next election came, they would choose another set of electors and representatives, which would then be attuned to the next election, so that in the fourth year of choosing of the president, the elector that they chose for that election year would actually be the one that would go and meet in the state as the electoral college for the state and actually choose the president and choose the vice president. That's their only job. I don't even believe it was compensated. It was a job of honor, privilege, and, you know,
and trust.
Right. And so we have these two different representatives. They're both our representatives.
So that's interesting because I don't see anywhere where this line has been repealed.
No, it hasn't. And as a matter of fact, that's why this is highly highlighted in red. It's black text, but it's highlighted in red. And the electors of each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors of the most numerous branch. So in other words, these electors have the same prerequisites that they have to meet. They have to be 25 years of age and so forth. So we'll get into the prerequisites, okay? And that's the following line here. So go ahead and read the following line.
Okay. No person shall be a representative who shall not have attained to the age of 25 years and been 7 years a citizen of the United States, and who shall not, when elected, be an inhabitant of that state in which he shall be chosen.
So in other words, he has to be a citizen and a resident of the state where they've been chosen.
Now here's an important point. Uh-huh. And I don't know if you remember this, but back when Alan Keyes ran against Barack Obama in Illinois for Senate, and I believe it may have been in 2006. And what happened is Alan Keyes moved from the East Coast to Illinois, but he still qualified because it says he was an inhabitant of the state at the time he was elected.
Yes.
He shall not, when elected, be an inhabitant of the state of that state. So he was actually campaigning for that seat, but was also moving there at the same time. I thought that was as interesting. So you don't have to live there maybe when you're campaigning, but that by the time you're elected, you had better be an inhabitant of that state.
Yes. Okay. So okay,
I just thought I would point that out.
Right. Okay. That's fine. So go ahead and read the next one.
Okay. Representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states.
Go ahead.
What? This is modified by...
Okay, so yeah. You have this text that is in italicized, and this whole portion of this whole text has been modified by the 16th Amendment. So go ahead.
Okay. Which may be included within this union. Let me start over again. Representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states, which may be included within this union according to their respective numbers, which shall be determined by adding to the whole number of free persons, including those bound to service for a term of years, and excluding Indians not taxed, 3/5 of all other persons.
Right. Okay, so the 3/5, we knew that was relating to slaves.
Article.
And that Indians not taxed could not be represented.
Mm-hmm.
So this is all the apportionment. This is how we determine. And so we just ran out of time, Paul. So, folks, we'll actually pick this back up. We'll start off where we left off for tomorrow. So when we come back tomorrow, we'll just pick this up so we can kind of go through how this is being violated. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort.
We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.